Iran says it's carefully watching, quote, the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel in the region. The Afghan government and a group of political leaders agree to form a joint command center for public uprising forces in the fight against the Taliban. And firefighters in Greece are struggling for the eighth straight day to control wildfires in the island of Evia that have caused massive destruction. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Great pleasure to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that the Islamic Republic is carefully monitoring what he's calling the U.S., U.K., and Israel's suspicious moves in the region. Ali Shamkhani says that such moves are aimed at creating chaos and confusion among Persian Gulf states. He underlined the fact that Tehran is prepared to neutralize any plot aimed at destabilizing the region. Shamkhani made those comments during a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein. The Iranian officials said that U.S. presence and its interference in other countries' internal affairs increase regional tension. He noted that regional states are able to secure themselves without outside interference. A political commentator, John Bosnich, believes that the U.S. is bullying the countries in the West Asia region at the behest of Israel.
As usual, the United States is bullying the countries in the region, and they're doing so at the behest of Israel. Israel uses its lobbying power in Washington to tell the United States what to do. Iran is the current target in the region, and what they're going to do at first is to just test your responsiveness and to see what the response of Iran is as tensions rise. If Iran appears to be ready to defend itself effectively, usually bullies don't like a fight. They like to just bully people. So it's quite likely that the United States and Israel will pull back, the same with the UK. If it looks like Iran is not ready to defend itself, if there's a weakness in the Iranian defenses, then usually they'll try, as usual, without any reference whatsoever to international law, they'll try and make an attack, as they've done all around the world.
The Taliban say they've captured the capital of the western border province of Farah as they continue with their rapid advances across the country. A local lawmaker also confirmed that the militants gained control of the governor's office and police headquarters in the city of Farah. He said the militants entered the city after a brief fight with security forces. This is the seventh provincial capital to fall into the hands of the Taliban in less than a week. Meantime, President Ashraf Ghani and a group of political leaders have agreed to form a joint command center to mobilize public uprising forces against the Taliban. The UN Human Rights Chief has called on the militants to stop their military operations and warned of possible war crimes during the militant group's operations. Palestinian factions have denounced Saudi Arabia over its verdict against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians, handing jail terms of up to 22 years. The group was detained in March 2018 during a wave of arrests by Saudi authorities. Ruba Shabat has more from Gaza.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years, while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced a national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits, and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us, as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Now in the U.S., as more victims speak out about alleged sexual abuse at the hands of New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo, a new development in a case that sent shockwaves on both sides of the Atlantic in 2019. Sexual abuse allegations against Britain's Prince Andrew and his friendship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Our London correspondent, Said Kurosa, brings us up to speed.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A lawsuit brought against the Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on 3 occasions.
He knows what he's done, and he can attest to that.
In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice.
I think that everyone should be made accountable for their behavior and their actions. It doesn't matter who they are.
I believe in there's no smoke without fire, to be honest. There has to be something there.
I'm doubtful anything will come of it, just because the U.S. criminal justice system isn't necessarily known for listening to women.
I think he deserves prison time for it and proper justice.
But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing. In a car crash interview with the British public broadcaster in November 2019, he claimed he had never slept with Giuffre.
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. After that, the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him. 66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Greek firefighters are struggling for the 8th straight day to bring wildfires raging on the island of Evie under control. They've caused massive destruction. Some 900 firefighters, assisted by foreign reinforcements, are trying to slow down and contain the blazes on the resort island. The fires have claimed 3 lives. They've forced evacuation of thousands of people. Authorities say that more than 580 wildfires have erupted in recent days. They've devoured thousands of hectares of forests. Greece's neighbor Turkey is also battling devastating blazes. That's been nearly 2 weeks, as the Mediterranean region is suffering its worst heat wave in decades. The United Nations has released a harrowing assessment of the current climate conditions. It's a warning of devastating impacts of global warming in the decades to come. Politicians and activists have called the report a wake-up call to change our ways and save Earth.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States and Canada, the unprecedented and deadly floods in Western Europe, the soaring temperatures across the world, and severe droughts elsewhere. These are all harbingers of a devastating climate crisis that is to come. The United Nations released its most comprehensive report on climate change yet on Monday. In the document, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said humans are to blame for the strange and tragic natural catastrophes the world is witnessing. The definite tone marked a contrast from the language used in previous reports, which had said industrial activity was extremely likely to blame. In a statement, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a code red for humanity. The report was published less than 3 months before the United Nations Climate Change Conference 2021, which will be hosted by Scotland. IPCC findings are expected to feature prominently in the discussions.
I think it's too late to keep things as they were. What we have to do is figure out how to moderate the influences of all this. And I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight.
The UN Climate Panel, IPCC, comprises thousands of scientists across 195 countries who compile peer-reviewed research articles about global warming into a report. This year's report was written by over 230 authors who have reviewed some 14,000 research papers.
The report paints a stark picture of what the world would look like unless it cuts carbon emissions. The 2015 Paris Climate Accord set the target of limiting global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. But as of December 2020, not a single country was on course to meet that target. Now, in that case, is there any hope of saving the environment and staving off a climate disaster?
The IPCC report warns that even in the case of the sharpest cuts in emission, the world might not be able to maintain the global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Accord, adding that without immediate steep cuts, the average temperatures will soar past 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Moreover, according to the report, even if the world manages to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, extreme weather conditions will continue to become more common and intense. A rise in sea levels also seems inevitable, as the report says even with the most severe cuts in carbon emissions, the melting of polar ice will elevate sea levels for hundreds or even thousands of years. All is not lost, however, as the IPCC suggests there is still time to prevent the worst-case scenario. The UN panel says the world has about a decade to decrease the rate at which it pumps carbon into the atmosphere before it's too late. Activists and politicians reacted to the findings with alarm.
We're not talking about the root cause itself, the things that is actually fueling these events. We are not holding people in power accountable. We are not talking about the current best available science, what it says, and how the situation looks like now. And we are especially not talking about the gap between what politicians are saying and what they are actually doing.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the IPCC report a wake-up call, while U.S. President Joe Biden called for action to fight climate change.
I think a lot of the people who have the power and the money have absolutely no idea how bad things are because they simply refuse to admit it, and because they're still looking at short term and making more money this quarter and getting elected next time.
Many have so far shrugged off climate warnings and believe the concept of global warming and climate change to be a hoax. But now that there are more signs of climate change than ever before, will there be a universal consensus and will to counter the devastating impact we're exerting on the planet?
In town and police have clashed with protesters rallying in capital Bangkok against the government's handling of the COVID-19 and its impact on the economy. Police used water cannons and tear gas to disperse the rallies. Scores of riot police were deployed ahead of the protests that was supposed to involve a convoy of cars. Demonstrators demand the resignation of Prime Minister Prayuth Chaucha. This is the second rally this week, with people defying restrictions on public gatherings, and that's while the country is battling its worst COVID outbreak. Thailand had a record 235 deaths and around 20,000 new cases on Tuesday. The figures pushed the country's caseload to over 770,000 and a death to over 6,000 since the outbreak of the pandemic. China's COVID cases have surged to a seven-month high after a cluster at a test site helped drive up numbers. Health authorities confirmed 143 new infections on Tuesday, 108 of them locally transmitted. Dozens of cases in recent days have been linked to a COVID testing site in the eastern state of Yangzhou. According to Chinese media, the current outbreak is the worst in the country since the virus emerged in the central city of Wuhan in late 2019. The outbreak has triggered lockdowns, mass testing, and travel restrictions nationwide. China largely contained COVID-19 the past month. Now its grip on the pandemic is facing challenges as the Delta variant is spreading. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. Parts of the United Kingdom have again faced rain and localized flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Elmira Tanatarova. The piece is titled Areas Hit by Flooding as Torrential Rain Sweeps Across Parts of UK. Parts of the UK have again faced rain and localised flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The dismal summer weather continued on Saturday, 7th of August, with parts of London and Glasgow flooded due to heavy rain, and the Met Office warning that torrential rain will continue to affect the southeast of England throughout the day. There are also warnings of heavy rain, thunderstorms, flooding, lightning strikes, cold winds and hail in central and southern Scotland, in northern England and Northern Ireland for this weekend. There is hope that summer may not be over, with drier conditions forecast for later in the month. Videos and photographs of heavy flooding on the roads and drains full of water were posted on social media by people in Walthamstow in northeast London and Battersea in south London, and two London Underground stations, Stepney Green and Holborn, closed due to the flooding, as well as a platform at Liverpool Street station. There was also flooding in Drumchapel, Glasgow, with one video posted on Twitter showing a car abandoned by its owners under a railway bridge. However, it is likely the weather will clear up for a chance at a drier summer towards the end of August. Met Office meteorologist Becky Mitchell told the Press Association news agency it's going to stay quite changeable at least for the next week, but as we head towards the end of August, there's likelihood we'll see hotter spell of weather and drier, more settled weather across the whole of the United Kingdom. While it is too early to predict temperatures at this stage, it could potentially be in the high 20s. Meteorologist Becky Mitchell said that even though it may not seem like it, this summer has been warmer and drier than average. She said, it's not been wetter on average, but we've seen a lot of reports on the news about flooding. That's why it may feel like a bad summer with not much warmth or sunshine. She explained that the only exception has been the southeast of England, which has been wetter than usual and has already had 111% of its average rainfall for the summer. Becky Mitchell added, the cause of the torrential rain and thunderstorms is down to the fact that July was so hot. She said, we've had quite a lot of warm weather and there was a heat wave during the middle part of July. The end of that heat wave triggered a lot of thunderstorms and heavy and intense rain, which is what brought some of those flooding incidents across parts of the southeast of England. There has been a lot of rainfall in a short amount of time, creating localized flooding events rather than it being a wet period. The worst hit places appear to be the City of London, which has had 143% of its average rainfall this summer, the Isle of Wight, with 174% of its average summer rainfall, and Surrey, with 126% of its average rainfall. Becky Mitchell believes the Isle of Wight will only get rainier and imagines the percentage will be much higher by the end of the summer. By comparison, Scotland has only had 38% of its average rainfall, and Becky Mitchell says a few northern areas have been much, much drier.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, please accept our condolences on these days of Muharram, which are the days of sorrow for the Ahlul Bayt. Peace be upon them. Now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If we go back in history, brothers and sisters, we realize that after the death of the Prophet, we know what happened at Saqifa when the caliphate, the khilafat, was taken away from Amir al-Mu'mineen and it was placed in the hands of individuals who did not have the best interest of the Ummah of Islam at heart. Eventually, Amir al-Mu'mineen is given the khilafat. We know he was Imam from day one. He was asked by the community after the death of the third caliph to take upon the leadership of Islam, and he accepted with conditions. The people accepted him. We know for 4 years he suffered tremendously. The battle of Siffin, the battle of Nahrawan, he had to fight, you know, with Muawiyah, he had to fight against Aisha, the wife of Rasulullah, in the battle of Jamal. And eventually, obviously, we know that 4 years or just under that amount of time after this khilafat was given to him, he was attacked in Masjid al-Kufa, he was killed, and his son Imam Hassan alayhi salam took over the imamate and also the political authority, the caliphate. I don't want to go into all the details, but we know that there was a issue because in Sham, in Damascus, was a man named Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. May Allah deal with this man with Allah's justice for what he did to this religion of Islam. Unfortunately, he had so much authority given to him by the previous Khulafa and his family, the Banu Umayyah, who had a hatred for Banu Hashim, for Rasulullah and his family. He took out his anger, and we see that it was in the month of Rajab. He had been, you know, in charge of the Ummah for many years after what the mainstream Muslims and what the Orientalists call the abdication of the throne or abdication of power of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. But Imam Hassan alayhi salam signed a peace treaty with Muawiyah. Things were agreed upon. Muawiyah agreed to follow these. And unfortunately, or we could say fortunately, he showed his true colors and broke the contract that he had made with Imam Hassan alayhi salam. In short, Imam Hassan is killed. We know he's poisoned. Imam Hussein is bearing patiently the difficulties. And a point comes in the month of Rajab, in the year 60 after the Hijrah, that Muawiyah leaves this world. He had a sickness, he had an illness, and Allah took him. And in the time that Muawiyah lost his life, a message comes from the next apparent, the heir apparent, his son Yazid, la'natullah alayh. And the message comes to all the Muslim regions, but especially to Medina, Madinatul Munawwara, the city of Rasulullah, where Yazid tells the governor who was in charge at that time, Walid, that you need to take the oath of allegiance from the inhabitants of Medina, first and foremost. But more so than just the people of Medina, there are a few specific people you need to take the oath of allegiance from. And one of those is Hussein ibn Ali, alayhi salam. And he makes it clear, Yazid makes it clear from day one, that if he does not give you the ubayyah, the oath of allegiance, take his head and bring it to me in Damascus. And so at night, when Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, is with some companions in the masjid of the Prophet, One of the messengers, the emissaries of Walid, the governor of Medina, comes to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and says that the governor needs to speak to you. And Imam Hussein was no, you know, he knew what was happening. He knew what the situation was. He goes with his entourage of about 20 or some odd people, as the historians mention. He goes to the palace of Walid. And he knows that something has happened to Muawiyah. Walid tells him the situation that, you know, Muawiyah has died. Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. We are all from Allah. We all are owned by Allah. We all go back to Allah. And he's now told that you need to give the bayah, the allegiance to his son Yazid Mal'un. There is a long debate and an argument that happens between Abu Abdullah and Walid, in which Abu Abdullah goes on to say, and I'll paraphrase the words, where he says that we are the Ahlul Bayt of Nubuwa, we are the spring of knowledge, we are the ocean of the Quran, the spring of the Quran. Yazid, you want me to give my oath of allegiance to Yazid, who is Sharibul Khamr, one who drinks alcohol, where he kills innocent people. He has no regard for the rules of Islam. And Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam says, Mithli la yubayi mithla, that one like me would never pay allegiance to a man like Yazid. A dispute ensues, he leaves, and Marwan ibn al-Hakam is there. He tells Walid that you have lost your chance to take the oath of allegiance. Things are not going to go smooth for you from this point on. Continuing on this, and we'll end in the next couple of minutes, is that the next few days go by. They're trying to pressure Abu Abdullah. He realizes that this is it, that this is the ultimatum, that this is what he had been foretold would happen to him by Rasulullah. One evening he goes to the masjid of the Prophet, brothers and sisters, and he sits at the foot of the grave of Rasulullah, and he pours his heart out to the Prophet. He recites some poetry to Rasulullah about the state that he finds himself in, and he goes home. Another night he comes back to the grave of Rasulullah, and he sits at the grave, and he falls into some state of sleep or some state between awake and sleep, and we're told he sees a vision. He sees a vision of Rasulullah, where his beloved grandfather is speaking to him, and he says to him, Ya Aba Abdullah, Ya my grandson, O Hussein. He says that your father is here waiting for you. Your mother, Lady Zahra, is here waiting for you. Your brother, Hassan, is here waiting for you. Rasulullah tells his grandson, Hussein, he says that, Ya Hussein, he says that there is a status reserved for you with Allah that you cannot attain except through shahada, except through martyrdom. He's welcoming him into the club of martyrdom. He's giving him that premonition, reminding him of that premonition that Abu Abdullah had been given so many times before, that this would be the time that he would have to give his life for the preservation of this religion. He makes his way to Jannatul Baqi. He bids his farewell to his beloved mother Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam. He bids farewell to his brother Hassan alayhi salam, who had been poisoned, whose body had been full of the poison of the same Muawiyah through his instigations. And he bids farewell to the family. He gives a last wasiyah, a testament to his brother Muhammad al-Hanafiya, his half-brother. And in that historic document, he writes a few lines, and he reminds not only his brother, but he tells you and I, where he says, Inni lam akhruj ashiran wala batiran wala zaliman wala mufsidan. He says, I'm not making this movement, this stance, out of corruption or out of vanity or out of pride or out of arrogance. He says, إِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لِتَلَبِ الْإِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي. I'm only seeking to bring about reformation in the nation of my grandfather. He reminds Muhammad al-Hanafiya, أُرِيدُ أَنْ أَمُرَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَأَنْهَى عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. I'm only seeking to enjoin good and forbid evil. And in doing this, I am following in the seerah of Jaddi wa Abi, of my grandfather and my father. Brothers and sisters, as Abu Abdullah leaves this wasiyah with his half-brother Muhammad al-Hanafiyya, he begins to pack his belongings. He begins to tell the women and children of the family. He begins to speak to some of the companions. He tells them that we're going on a journey. If you want to come with me, you can come, but realize that there is no return. This is a one-way ticket that you're taking, a one-way journey. It's a one-way journey to Jannah. As he gathers the family in these last days, in those last days of Rajab, he gathers all the belongings, he gathers the family together, and they begin their journey towards Mecca. They begin their journey towards Mecca, where he would stay for so many months. He would reach in Sha'ban, he would stay in Sha'ban, and Ramadan, and Shawwal, and Dhul Qa'dah, and Dhul Hijjah. And as we know, on the 8th of Muharram, on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah rather, the Yawm al-Tarawiyyah, and Abu Abdullah makes the intention to go towards the city of Kufa, where his cousin Muslim ibn Aqil had been sent as his representative. And as we know, and as we'll continue to lament in these nights to come, that he would not make it to Kufa. Abu Abdullah would be stopped at a place called Nainawa, at a place called Taf, at a place that we, you and I, know as Karbala. And this would be the outcome, that what we are commemorating in these nights would be the tragedy of the day of Ashura. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. UK government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Diane Taylor and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled UK Home Office Records 70 Racist Incidents by Far Right at Asylum Accommodation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a Freedom of Information response obtained by The Guardian, the UK Home Office has recorded 70 racist incidents by far-right supporters against asylum seekers in barracks and hotel accommodation. However, campaigners supporting asylum seekers in such accommodation say the figure is a significant underestimation of the true picture. The data, which covers 1st of January 2020 until 13th of July this year, involves incidents in the much-maligned Napier and Penally barracks, which have been under intense scrutiny by MPs after their untenable conditions were revealed, as well as a large-scale COVID outbreak in the former. Penally barracks in Pembrokeshire, Wales, was closed in March, despite only being opened in September of 2020, along with Napier in Folkestone, Kent. Hotels have been used throughout the period, but their use for asylum seekers increased sharply after the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. In Napier barracks, four incidents were recorded between September and December of 2020, with 12 occurring so far this year. This is despite the barracks being temporarily emptied in April after the coronavirus outbreak. There are now thought to be 176 asylum seekers living there. Several incidents at Penally Barracks was reported to the Home Office last year, and many in 2021. Witness statements from legal challengers by asylum seekers living there reveal a catalogue of disturbing episodes, including an attempt to ram a refugee with a car. Others include stones and bottles being thrown, rape threats, attempts to start fights, fireworks shot through the gate, and eggings. According to witness statements, a farm shop in the area said some of the far-right supporters had asked to buy pigeon scarers to mimic the sound of gunfire and frightened asylum seekers. The number of incidents recorded in hotels has tripled this year, with 40 examples reported, up from 13 last year. Saturday, 7th of August, the far-right organisation Britain First posted a video on its website headlined Britain First Exposes an Illegal Immigrant Hotel in Hull, in which members of the organisation say they posed as journalists to confront asylum seekers. One asylum seeker from Yemen experienced two incidents involving far-right protesters at his Home Office-provided hotel on the outskirts of London. He said, "They were driving around the hotel recording us on video," adding, "They were insulting us, swearing at us, and screaming things like, 'Go out from our country. Why are you eating our food? Go away from us. You are strangers here.' We were too scared to go outside the hotel and felt like it was a prison. We had to stay inside." He added, "We fled countries where there is war and destruction and felt safe when we arrived here. But when we saw this kind of racist attack, we felt we were not protected." Maddie Harris of Humans for Rights Network said, "Ghettoizing people seeking safety in large-scale accommodation such as hotels and army barracks exposes them to harm. The figures shown here are not an accurate representation of the level of racial abuse endured by the people we support. We have had numerous conversations with asylum seekers where they have told us how unsafe they feel due to frequent incidents of racial abuse and that they have experienced in and around these accommodations." Claire Mosley, The founder of Care for Calais said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. Our government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities, rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." The Home Office spokesperson said, "It is unacceptable for anyone in asylum accommodation to experience hostile or racist incidents, and we ensure each incident is thoroughly investigated. We work closely with a range of organizations to ensure immediate support and assistance is provided to people living in the accommodation, and if needed, escalate to law enforcement." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible, on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen from the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union Settlement Scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national who requested anonymity told the Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain European Union nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures. The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of being forwarded digitally." Aranea Kogolathos, a barrister and legal manager of BIDS EEA, European Economic Area Project, said, "Paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals." Barrister Aranea Kogolathos said, "Despite having made the European Union Settlement Scheme applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, has encouraged both the people and officials to carefully observe the health protocols for the prevention of COVID-19 from the early days of the outbreak. In addition, he himself has obeyed the regulations enacted by the National Committee on combating corona even more than others. Moreover, His Eminence has reminded both the people and officials of the necessity of observing the enacted rules in various speeches. Insistence on observing the health protocols during Muharram mourning ceremonies. I wish to say something about Muharram. There are many debates about Muharram. People have been speaking about Muharram for a long time. Well, they will hold the mourning ceremonies one way or another. But what I want to stress is that in mourning ceremonies, the main criterion is what medical experts, the National Anti-Corona Headquarters, announce to us. I myself will observe whatever action they deem necessary. My firm recommendation to all those who wish to participate in the mourning ceremonies, including mourning committees, those who take the member, the organizers, panegyrists, performers of elegies and like, is this, before you do anything, you should see what they say. If the National Anti-Corona Headquarters issue certain regulations for these occasions, all of us will have a duty to observe them. The issue is not a minor issue, rather it is a very important one. In the present time, there is supervision and control to some extent. However, if God forbid, these measures are taken lightly and if people do not observe them, then there will be a disaster with unclear consequences at the end. July 31st, 2020.
انا مظلوم حسين انا مظلوم حسين انا مظلوم حسين انا مظلوم حسين انا لاتشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September
27th, 2017.
The next point is that I strongly ask all the organizations in the country to cooperate responsibly with the Ministry of Health, which is in the front line of confronting this disease, and to provide it with all resources and amenities. Of course, I have also asked the armed forces and the organizations which are in contact with my office to provide the people with all their resources in this regard. March 3rd, 2020. Of course, countries have different performances in managing coronavirus. Not all countries are the same. Some countries, such as the US, whose management is among the worst ones on this matter, have had the worst management and some are in a better condition. We should try to exercise the best management so that we can pass through this event. This is a very important event. October 24th, 2020.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.